Hi, welcome back to ARZone. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. In this, our second series of interviews, in association with VegFest UK, we'll be addressing the issue of total liberation through radical veganism in the lead-up to the VegFest UK London event in October 2017. In today's interview, Roger and I are pleased to welcome Casey Taft back to ARZone. Casey is a professor of psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine and an internationally recognized researcher in the areas of trauma, family communication, and violence prevention. Casey sees the prevention of violence toward other animals as a natural extension of his work with humans. He's the co-owner of Vegan Publishers and has published over 100 journal articles, book chapters, and scientific reports, as well as recently authoring Millennial Vegan, Motivational Methods for Animal Advocacy, and Trauma-Informed Treatment and Prevention of Intimate Partner Violence. Casey, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to ARZone. Thanks for joining us.
It's always lovely to talk to you both.
Thanks, Casey. One of your talks, Casey, at VegFest this year is about trauma in animal advocacy. And you've said that animal advocates often have some form of trauma in their backgrounds. Someone said something similar to me many years ago, which I find really interesting. Do you think that those humans who've suffered or been exploited themselves are drawn to animal advocacy because they think they can relate to similar exploitation and oppression of other animals? And if so, is that a problem?
So I think there's definitely something to that. I think my experience has been, I don't know any animal advocate who doesn't have some form of trauma in their past. And it seems like when I'm out giving talks about animal advocacy, when I talk about trauma, by far the biggest reaction I get from folks after one of my talks is they come up and talk to me about trauma they've experienced, or that it somehow helped them make a connection between the trauma they experienced and their animal advocacy. I do think that when we're exposed to trauma, when we're exposed to needless violence ourselves, you know, whether it's through childhood, whether it's experiencing abuse or interpersonal violence, that for many of us, we kind of make a decision early on that we're going to kind of, that, you know, we develop a sense of injustice. And I think we decide, and I can say this is definitely true for myself. I decided really early on that I was going to, you know, do whatever I could to prevent needless violence, needless trauma. And I'm sure even if it's not a conscious process, for a lot of animal advocates, they kind of feel the same way. So as to the second part of your question, is it a problem? I don't think it's a problem. You know, we have all different responses to trauma. I think for many of us, you know, we grow from them and we become, you know, stronger advocates. We become better people. The only real problems lie when we don't adapt well to trauma, when we develop other problems, such as PTSD and other problems where it really can be more problematic.
Yeah, thanks, Casey. I've heard it said, and I don't know how I feel about it, when we sort of base our advocacy on our own traumatic experiences, it tends to make us more emotional and it takes away some of the rationality.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I think I've definitely experienced and observed that can happen. That I think, well, anytime you're talking about a population that has experienced a lot of trauma, that often it can impact the way we view things. And actually, my research on domestic violence is really all about this, that when we experience trauma, and especially when we develop PTSD and other problems, we're more, it may affect the way we react to other people and the way we interpret situations. So in my violence work, a big focus of our research and our clinical programs is to help folks understand if they've experienced trauma, if they have PTSD, how they may be misinterpreting other people. And what often happens is when you have trauma, when you have PTSD, you assume other people and you're kind of on guard, you're in survival mode and you go on the attack. And I've certainly seen a lot of that in animal advocacy, where I've seen animal advocates who may have, you know, trauma histories, they may have PTSD, they completely kind of jump to the wrong conclusion about others. They assume the worst in others, and then they kind of distort the reality of the situation, and they go on the attack and act aggressive or otherwise harmful to others. So I think that's a good example of where it can be harmful. But the experience of trauma in and of itself is not necessarily harmful. Like, we all react differently to it, and most people who experience trauma don't necessarily PTSD or misinterpret situations. So, you know, it's, we have to kind of think of there's certain responses to trauma that are, you know, more harmful than others.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks, Casey.
Sure.
Hi, Casey. Roger here. Your second talk is called Tips for Navigating Relationships, Wellness, and Everyday Life as an Animal Advocate. So rather than just simply asking you what you're going to say, I thought I'd ask you what I think is a related question. And this is it, that a lot of people argue that it's very negative, a negative thing to criticize other animal advocates or other vegans, and that's usually accompanied by appeals for movement unity. However, I'm not sure whether such an anything for the animals is good approach is actually good for the well-being of any social movement, including ours, or even for the individuals in social movements. At the same time, it's pretty hard to navigate relationships while being critical and or oppositional. So can your own expertise speak to any of that?
I hope so. And that
well,
is
go for it then.
So, and that is kind of the focus of my talk, and it's, which is loosely based on my book Millennial Vegan, and it's also, I talk about this in Motivational Methods for Vegan Advocacy as well. I agree with the premise of what you're saying, that we do need to obviously be critical of what we're doing in our movement, how we're engaging in advocacy, what others are doing. That definitely has to happen. But I feel like the way it does happen is often not the most helpful way. And the way that messages get kind of delivered is not always it's not always presented in a way that's most likely to be received. So, and I guess for myself, I have good practice in this, you know, as a psychologist, and because in my world, you know, as a clinical researcher, where we're doing like violence prevention research, we criticize each other a lot. You know, I mean, that's really what my job is about receiving criticism and responding to it. But the form that it comes is different, where it's done in a respectful way, where in a non-attacking, non-shaming kind of way. And even then, it's difficult to receive, you know, when somebody tells you that your work is not good or it's not important or whatever it is that they're criticizing you for. But in the end, you know, hopefully it makes the end product better. So I think that we do need to be critical of ourselves. We need to be critical of others. But the way we present it may make a difference in terms of how it's received by others. And I think we also just have to ourselves try, and this isn't an easy thing to do, but to try to be aware of our own responses, you know, our own defensiveness, our own like fragility or whatever it is that we're feeling. And really try to listen to criticism that others are kind of levying against us. So I really try to do this. You know, often our first reaction is you want to get really defensive and deny and you know, argue back with the other person. But I think really the ideal approach would be to find a way to listen to what they're actually trying to say.
Yeah, it's all about communication skills in the end. We just recently, interviewed James Aspie, and he was saying that sometimes you get the impression that as soon as you join a movement, you lose your people skills, and it's kind of like the last thing you need to do, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. No. I think people skills are really, really important. You know, I often wonder how non-psychologists are able to navigate some of these spaces. You know, like as a publisher of a, you know, as a vegan publisher where I work with all kinds of folks, you know, from all walks of life, like I feel like if I weren't a psychologist, I would have a very difficult time like doing what I do. I don't honestly know how other people do it if they don't have the kind of training and experiences that I have. You know, when you do therapy with hundreds of people, it really helps you learn how to listen a little bit better and work on communicating a little better. But it's really hard. It's hard for me as well, even with my background.
Yeah. Thanks, Casey.
Sure.
Casey, you've written and you've spoken a lot about pseudoscience and flawed or biased research from within the animal advocacy community. You wrote about it in your first book too. It seems that more and more we're seeing claims being made about reducitarianism, for example, being the most, in inverted commas, effective way to advocate for veganism. This seems like a direct contradiction, of course, but those studies and research that you've written about and that you've studied yourself are often used to support these views. Would you please speak about this issue and what dangers there are in using pseudoscience and flawed and biased research to support any form of advocacy?
Yeah, I think that's a really serious issue. That it seemed like for a while that the research in the that's used in animal advocacy by various groups tends to be pretty one-sided in terms of the perspective of those who are doing the research, those who are funding the research, and often the conclusions that are drawn. And in the handful of studies that I've reviewed, I found that to really be a problem, that a lot of the conclusions drawn were not really consistent with the actual data. And it just seems to be that some are trying to make this case for reducitarianism or for just asking people to cut down on using animals or eating animals rather than going vegan. It seems like that some are really trying hard to make that case, and it doesn't feel like there's an honest attempt to really try to better understand different approaches and what might work the best. I've actually been on the inside of this a little bit, where I've seen grants get submitted to some of these organizations and not get funded. Grants that I thought were really good that would really get at some of what I think is most important, which is studying like specific motivational methods and to see whether they're effective or not. But it seems that that's not really where the money is going. That's not where the research is going. And it's concerning. So as somebody who does this for a living, who believes in, you know, science as important for understanding what works and how we can promote change in others, for me, it's actually offensive for me to see it used in a way to try to use in a way that I don't feel like is really honest, that I don't feel like is really what the scientific enterprise is supposed to be. Like there really isn't peer review for this research. It's not really run through the scientific process. And that's why I've had to kind of review some of this on my own, and I critique it on my own, because it's not really reviewed in the scientific community like any good science is usually done.
Yeah, I've spoken with a couple of the people who have been involved in some of the research, and they, although they don't make a point of saying so publicly, they readily admit that their studies or surveys are just a starting point. They're not, obviously, they're far from being peer reviewed, but they're more of a starting point for someone else to perhaps pick up and do more research. But I think the problem, and I know you and I kind of disagree on that a little bit, but one of the problems that I find is that you get other people who don't understand the studies and who will just read a headline, and they'll use that headline or, you know, a small part of the study that they've read. They'll right. use that to support their already deeply held views.
Right. Well, in science, there's a process for having a starting point. And that is like do pilot studies of specific interventions or pilot studies of comparisons of equally, you know, plausible theory driven interventions. And that's not what's done. So doing biased research, not getting it peer reviewed and just posting it online and sending it to the media is not really a starting point. That's really more like biased and flawed, you know, use of research in a harmful way.
Yeah, I agree with that. Casey, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us today. I know it's a busy time for you. Good luck in London, travel safely, and thank you again so much for everything that you continue to do. You're really making a difference and you're helping a lot of people. Thank you.
And you as well. And thanks so much for having me, and look forward to talking again soon.
No member of the animal kingdom nurses past maturity. No member of the animal kingdom ever did a thing to me. So I don't eat red meat or white fish. Don't give me no blue cheese.